This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night, Showtime presented the first installments in its TV adaptation of Armistead Maupin's More Tales of the City. The final installments will be shown tonight. Tales of the City is Maupin's humorous but emotional story of a group of straight and gay people who have come to San Francisco in the mid-70s and have together created a makeshift family. In this scene, Marianne, who is straight, has invited her best friend Michael, who is gay, on a cruise. Their friend Mona is driving them to the airport in a noisy Volkswagen Beetle.
You know what? This trip is going to work for me. I'm going to meet somebody, I know it. Not that you aren't the best company in the world, but...
Look, you don't have to explain that one. Anyway, I've got this dynamite plan. I spot a guy, right? Lounging out by the ship's pool, maybe, or whatever. And I saunter up, kind of casual-like, with you on my arm, all tanned and gorgeous. And then I say in my very butch's voice, "Hi, guy. I'm Michael Tolliver, and this is Marianne Singleton. Which one of us would you like?"
What if he doesn't want either one of you?
We push them off the first available cliff in Acapulco.
Tales of the City originated as a daily serial in the San Francisco Chronicle in 1976. Then it was adapted into a series of novels. In 1994, PBS broadcast a TV adaptation of the first novel. Although it got great ratings, it also evoked a hostile reaction from anti-gay groups. PBS withdrew from doing the sequel, and later Showtime picked it up. I asked Armistead Maupin what the most negative reaction was to the PBS miniseries.
Well, I suppose the bomb threat at the PBS station in Chattanooga, Tennessee was about as negative as you can get. And the Reverend Donald Wildman of the American Family Association put together a sort of 12-minute bootleg videotape of what he considered to be the nasty bits of the show, which he distributed to every member of Congress, which must have provided a number of old gentlemen with late-night entertainment.
What were the nasty bits?
Mostly female breasts, just long casual scenes of Dee Dee talking on the phone to a friend with her breasts exposed. The nudity in Tales of the City, as the nudity in More Tales of the City, is very ordinary. It's very natural. It almost never appears in the context of a sexual scene. It's just the way people walk around their rooms with no clothes on, often when there's no one there.
I should mention that there were also, I think, two state legislatures that condemned Tales of the City when it was on PBS?
Yes, Georgia and Oklahoma.
And what did that lead to? Did those states play it?
Yes, they did. They actually, in both of those places, I believe they were played. There was a pixelated version also that American Playhouse put out to certain PBS stations that chose to use that. By that I mean a sort of electronic pasty effect that went onto the end of the breasts in some scenes, which, for my money, ended up being far more titillating and sexually provocative than the nudity itself would have been.
Now, what were the parameters, if any, that you had to work with on PBS and now on Showtime in terms of what you could show? Like, say there were two gay characters kissing.
There were no parameters, and those weren't that wasn't the doing of PBS, I must say. PBS has gotten a lot of the credit and a lot of the blame, of course, for this show and doesn't really deserve much of either. It was Channel 4 in Great Britain that funded this project, came up with the $8 million that was needed to make it. By that, I mean the first miniseries, Tales of the City. And PBS came on board when we were well into the shooting. American Playhouse showed up on the set and said, "Great, we'll take it." As a consequence, we had a great deal of freedom. The folks at Channel 4 in Britain, where the books are extremely popular, wanted to recreate them as closely as possible. There were actually moments when I would say, "Well, we can lose that scene." I was having a bad day that day. I remember what it was like down at the Chronicle when I was writing that. And they would say, no, the fans will be very upset if we don't have that particular scene. So they created a template, which we have followed in More Tales of the City, that allowed the story to be told with all its idiosyncrasies exactly the way it is in the book. So I always feel a little uncomfortable when people ask me about the adaptations, because really the blame or the praise will end up being mine, because I'm not one of those authors who's in a position to complain about a lousy adaptation that's watered my material down. It is very, very faithful to the original books.
Armistead Maupin is my guest, the author of the Tales of the City series of novels, and More Tales of the City is currently being serialized on Showtime. Look back over the past, I don't know, 10 or 20 years for us and tell us how you think the way TV handles homosexuality has changed. In other words, what can be said, what can be shown, what television still seems to be uncomfortable about?
Well, in the first place, television is still uncomfortable about any display of same-sex affection. There's still a flap whenever there's even a minor kiss between couples of the same sex on broadcast television. That's one of the things I'm proudest of in More Tales of the City. Not that it's homoerotic, but that it is homoromantic. It provides something that I grew up hungry for as a young queer, namely to see someone like me in a truly cinematic, romantic scene that celebrated the love that I was beginning to feel. And broadcast television still does not want to do that.
Armistead, what's the capsule version of how Tales of the City got started?
Well, initially, I was writing for a small Marin County newspaper called the Pacific Sun, and I wanted to write a nonfiction story about the fact that heterosexuals were, I can't even say that word, heterosexuals were cruising the local Marina Safeway on Wednesday nights, if you please. They would go down there with their carts half empty and move slowly through the aisles and try to pick each other up. So I went down there on a Wednesday night and saw this, in fact, was happening. A lot of women in rhinestone-studded brushed denim pantsuits with one item in the cart, chatting up guys over the vegetable bin. But I couldn't find anybody that would fess up, that would actually admit to doing this. So I went home very frustrated and made up a prototypical new girl in town named Marianne Singleton. And I wrote a little fictional story about how she finally met the man of her dreams and at the supermarket, and he turned out to be there with the man of his dreams. And the story really struck a chord with a lot of people, especially single women who had found this to be their experience in San Francisco. And the Pacific Sun said, why don't you follow her from week to week and follow the gay man she met and see what happens? So I did that for about 5 weeks until our particular edition of the paper folded. And it was a very, very popular feature, so that 2 years later I was able to take the idea to the San Francisco Chronicle and propose that I do it on a daily basis.
Now, were you already out professionally when you were writing this? When you started?
I was not. When I first arrived at the Chronicle, I was still being a good little boy because I wanted the job really badly. And when they found out, or figured it out, about 6 weeks into it, when the gay subject matter started creeping in, this very avuncular old managing editor called me into his office and gave me a little speech about what a waste it was and what a fine young man I was and why didn't I like girls. And then told me that he was happy to have gay characters in the story, but he didn't want them to overrun the story. So he created a chart that he hung in his office. And one column said homosexual and the other one said heterosexual. And whenever a new character was introduced into the serial, it would go into the appropriate column. So I spent several weeks trying to figure out how I could queer this, for want of a better word, and came up with a plot line in which this alcoholic society matron has a brief, impetuous affair with her Great Dane. This, incidentally, never ended up in the book. But when I came in the next week, I made the editor put the dog in the heterosexual column. And that was the end of that. He stopped doing it.
So what did you say when your editor called you in and started lecturing you about homosexuality?
Well, I thanked him very much and said, that's quite a compliment that you consider me a catch, and that bolsters my my insecurity tremendously, and maybe I'll get a chance of, meeting a boyfriend. I was very much the character Michael Tolliver when I was writing Tales of the City. I was this dewy-eyed young thing from the South who was so excited about being out of the closet and so excited that I was finally going to get my life in order The problem was that I had not experienced any adolescent sexuality. This is true of a lot of gay men, even today. They really don't get it together until they're about 30 years old and confront their parents and their family and their employers. And when they're finally free to live their lives the way they want to, they do all that standing on the corner watching all the girls go by stuff that straight boys do when they're 15 years old. And that was the case with me. I was alternately, you know, a horn dog and a person who believed in romanticism to a very high degree. And I think that mix is one of the things that makes Michael Tolliver appealing to gay people even today.
Let me ask you this. Michael thinks, Michael reveals at one point that when he was 14, he was so worried about what would happen when he didn't get married that he had hoped to be paralyzed from the waist down by the time he was an adult, so no one would have to worry why he wasn't marrying a woman.
That was me.
Did you really want to be paralyzed?
That's a terrible thing to say, but I thought, what could happen to me that would relieve me of the responsibility of having to marry and go through this charade? And that was the only thing I could think of. I give myself a certain amount of credit because a lot of people come to the conclusion that, well, you just find a girlfriend, you know, you find a best friend and marry her, and then she's not in a position to tell anybody else you're gay, especially not in the South in 1958. But I liked my girlfriends all too much, the women that I knew who were part of my circle, who were really close friends, and some of whom remain that way, were too dear to me to cheat in that way. In those days, it would be easy to put off that information because you could still go around saying, well, I'm saving myself for after marriage. And nowadays, it would be harder. I mean, kids have a way of knowing these things because they're sexually active at a very early age.
When you were writing the Tales of the City column and then the books, it was all very timely. It was all very in the moment. And, you know, I think people are always really excited to see stories that reflect how they're living right now or a kind of fantasy version of how they're living right now. But now it's kind of like a time capsule of the 70s. I mean, even like on page one, when Michael has all these Valentine's Day resolutions, and one of them is, I will stop expecting to meet Jan Michael Vincent. I will inhale poppers only through the mouth. I mean, these are such 70s kind of references.
Yes, I was very aware at the time that I was writing about things that would be arcane one day. In fact, I've always had a sort of outsider's view on the moment. I think because I feel that I really should have lived sometime in 1910, and I've never really connected with any sort of modernity at any point. But the odd thing is that the books now work on some other entirely different level, which I can only ascribe to the fact that I did try to write about the human condition. The people respond in ways that are pretty timeless. The books have just become very, very popular in France. I was over there 2 weeks ago, sitting in a Virgin megastore on the Champs-Élysées. I only say that because I like the combination of those words. And people were coming to me and discussing the characters as if they had been created yesterday and were very angry or upset or in love with Michael or... They treated them the same way that they were treating them in San Francisco 22 years ago. That was an amazing thing to see.
My guest is Armistead Maupin. There's a new edition of his novel, More Tales of the City, which Showtime is currently serializing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Armistead Maupin, his novel, More Tales of the City, is currently being serialized on Showtime. You know, one of the central relationships in the series is the relationship between Michael and Marianne, and, you know, she's a straight woman, he's a gay man. Have you thought a lot about the kind of friendship that often develops between straight women and gay men?
Yes, I have thought about it. In fact, I was acutely aware that I was one of the first people to record it. I wanted to celebrate it because so much of my life had been, I had been rescued by straight women when I arrived in San Francisco, because I went out there all wide-eyed and stupid, trying to throw myself into, you know, every romance and falling in love with every person I met at the baths. And the only person I could really talk to would be my straight girlfriend, who would come back and regale me with stories of what she had done the night before. And in a way, we could both sit there and talk about men together in a way that didn't threaten each other. And I was fascinated by the dynamics of that. It's always been celebrated, but usually in a more oblique way. I mean, that's what Christopher Isherwood was writing about when he created Sally Bowles. And then the next generation, Truman Capote, when he created Holly Golightly. Although both of those creations ended up being diluted when they got to some film form, so that the full-fledged homosexuality of the male character was denied or blurred or left ambiguous. And I wanted to be really clear about it, that this was not about the potential for romance, that this was about true, loving, connecting friendship.
Now, why do you think that the only person you could really confide in was a straight woman? Did you not have gay men who were friends?
Not in the beginning, and I think that's reflected in Tales of the City. I had some, but mostly they were just tricks. You know, there were people I'd pick up overnight and then not connect with, or a romance that would break my heart after a week, so I'd go back to the women friends. In a matter of years, I suppose, a year and a half or so, I was beginning to learn that gift for making friends with gay men, and of course that was reflected in the Tales of the City novels. As the story goes on, you see those kinds of friendships and those kinds of families building. I think that's one of the great gifts of gay life. I've recently, a couple of years ago actually, my partner Terry and I moved apart. We live in separate places now, and our relationship has opened up and to a degree that we see other people. But our love has reached some new plateau that is really quite extraordinary to me. And the comfort that I received in our relationship, knowing that there was another person in the world for me, is still very much there. And I think we were able to pull that off because we didn't, adopt a scorched earth policy after we broke up. We wanted very much to keep the love intact.
Well, you mentioned family, you know, in Tales of the City, for instance, the characters... Most of the younger characters are for one reason or another, really alienated from their parents. And they think of the family as being the people who they live in the apartment house with and the people who they've become friends with in San Francisco. And I assume it was kind of that way for you when you came to San Francisco, that the people who you became close to there became your family. I'm wondering how much of that new family actually stayed together. In other words, if you're still close with any of that family that you initially developed?
Well, in the first place, the family at 28 Barbary Lane is really pieces of me. I can't say that anything like that actually happened in real life. All of those characters are different aspects of my own personality. And Mrs. Madrigal is the Olympian voice, not to make a pun on our actress's name, who presides over it all. So in some ways, Tales of the City was simply my shrink. But yes, many of the people that I have come to know and think of as family over the years are very much still a part of my life. And I cringe when people say that this is a utopian vision, because it's not. It really works this way.
You know what I'm thinking must have been strange for you? You came to San Francisco knowing you were gay, but not really having had much in terms of relationships and experiences within
relationships. Not really having had much, yeah.
Yeah, and then shortly after that, you know, you start writing Tales of the City and you become a kind of hero to a lot of gay people through these characters that you've created. So suddenly you're kind of like the hero and the role model, and you're just kind of figuring out who you are yourself. It must have been a strange period for you.
Well, it was wonderful to have the story to work all that out in. You can see my whole life in there. You can see the first flushes of romance with Terry when I realized that I'd found a life partner. You can see my reeling shock over AIDS when it arrived on the scene. Baby Cakes, the fourth novel in the series, was the first fiction anywhere to deal with AIDS. And it was because I was writing in a daily newspaper and I had lost a young friend to it very suddenly, to pneumocystis pneumonia. And I simply plugged it into the story in 1983. So I was able to use this story as a way of explaining my own life to myself, which is what so many writers of fiction will tell you. It's the way that you contain it and make it make sense to yourself.
What are you working on now?
I have a novel in the works, the name of which I seem to be changing every week now. So I won't bother to announce it because I'm sure it'll change again. But it's a psychological suspense novel set in modern-day San Francisco. The central character bears a marked resemblance to me. He has a bookkeeper who's a 20-year-old Asian-American student whose name is Anna Halcyon Wilson, who is the child that was born to Dee Dee Halcyon Day in More Tales of the City. In other words, I've now reached such a stage of writerly senility that I'm having my own characters talk to me in the next novel.
Well, I wish you good luck with it, and I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I always enjoy it.
Armistead Maupin's novel, More Tales of the City, has just been reprinted to coincide with its serialization on Showtime. The final installments will be shown tonight. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.